case is number 2012-1116, in re Barton Patent 533. Mr. Grady, when you are ready.
Yes, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Keith Grady. I'm with the Polsinelli Schubert Law Firm, and I represent the appellant Barton Patent LLC in this appeal from a denial of claims 1 through 24, amended claims 1 through 24 of U.S. Patent 5166533 in reexamination. The Board of Patent Appeals and Interferences found that amended claims 1 through 24 of the 533 patent are unpatentable under 35 U.S.C. section 112 paragraph 1.
You may assume that we have brought ourselves up to speed on the background. Come right to your arguments.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, it's our position that there is no substantial evidence in the record to support the Board's finding that the disclosure of the 533 patent lacks sufficient support in the specification for the amendment of the claims to add the word directly to describe how the transfer of funds occurs between an individual's account. There's several portions of the patent that demonstrate direct transfers and provide written description support for that direct transfer. The first I'd like to point to is Figure 6. Figure 6 of the patent is described in the specification at column 4, lines 11 and 12, and that appears in the joint appendix at page A29. It's described as a complete schematic diagram.
But Figure 6 says from debit credit provider to savings program provider. If the word had, instead of provider, if the word had been account, then it would track the claims. But it doesn't, because the account requires it to go directly to a savings program account, directly to an account of the savings program. The savings program provider, though, could have multiple accounts, and it doesn't necessarily have to go directly into the savings program account that is designated for the individual. It could just go to the savings program provider and then be moved into an individual's account.
That's the problem.
That's the government's argument, as I understand.
I understand, Your Honor. But the savings program provider is described in the specification as the bank where the individual's savings account is located.
I agree, but a bank is not the same thing as the individual's account, right? Sending something to the bank is not the same thing as putting it in their account.
That's correct. The transfer of funds goes to the bank where the account is located and goes into the account. But there's no intervening accounts or structures between that transfer where funds are collected, accumulated, distributed, interest applied, like in the Burke 191 patent, which was cited extensively in the reexamination proceedings.
You're saying that there is no intervening account, but Figure 6 doesn't demonstrate that. Figure 6 only says send it from one provider to the other provider. We don't know what those providers are necessarily doing with it when they get it. This figure, how does it support the idea that the savings program provider is immediately depositing it right into the savings program account?
Well, there's no other description is provided other than it goes from the individual's debit credit transaction, which is the deposit account. That's number 26 in the figure. And it goes directly to number 28, which is the savings program provider, where the individual's savings.
When you say nothing else is disclosed, the government says at column 6, line about 11, through 16, that it discloses taking the IRA contribution, forwarding it to the main IRA database kept by the bank or financial institution. That would be the savings program provider. So they say the IRA contribution is forwarded to the bank where the savings account will be located, but they don't say that it's deposited straight into the savings account. They said it's first sent to an IRA database so that it can then be displayed to the customer's account or records. The IRA contributions are then sent sent to an individual investment account, then sent, that's two different sends. There's one sent to the savings program provider, and then there's the and then sent to the individual's account. Certainly sounds like two steps.
It sounds like two steps, but it's really not. And we explain this in our brief. There's two different things going on here. One is the transfer of money from account to account. The other is a transfer of data to be displayed in a database.
Where in this patent does it talk at all about a transfer of data as opposed to solely of a transfer of money?
Well, let's take column 6, for example, that we were just looking at. Column 6, lines 10 through 13, says the 1 to 5% contribution is forwarded to the main IRA database.
It doesn't say data about the contribution. It says the contribution itself. The same contribution that is then sent to the individual savings account. You may be right about theoretically how this is supposed to work, but then it's a poorly written spec, because in both cases you're referring to the thing that's being sent as the IRA contribution.
I understand, but I think the critical part is the difference between a display and a deposit into an account. That 1 to 5% contribution that's discussed at column 6, lines 10 through 13, is to be displayed to the customer's account. The IRA contributions are then sent to an individual investment account that's aligned with the current banking and savings account. And this is consistent with the claim structure. Originally issued claim 1, for example, says that the deposits go from account to account. Doesn't say anything about display of databases or sending information to be displayed in a database.
Maybe you can try one more time, because you cited column 6, lines 11 to 16 in your brief, but when I read it, I was shocked that you cited it, because it seemed clearly to support the government. And as you're standing here talking, I don't understand how you think that it supports your position, because as I read the plain language, you have the IRA contribution forwarded to the main IRA database kept by the bank. That sounds like a place other than the person's individual savings account, doesn't it?
Yes, that's the database where the data is displayed, not where the funds are deposited.
So the funds aren't being sent?
Correct.
At that point in time, no funds are being sent.
It's a signal representative.
But there's nothing in here anywhere that talks about a signal, and that says the 1 to 5% IRA contribution is forwarded. So how is that a signal representing the amount of the contribution?
Actually,
the contribution.
In original claim 1, as issued, there is a discussion of a computer to receive a signal representative of a payment amount from a third party, and that appears at column 9, lines 37 through 39. There's also in column 9.
Okay, that's great though, but here when you wanted to talk about a signal representative of a payment amount, you knew exactly how to do that. You referred to it as a signal representative of a payment amount. At column 6, the point you pointed to, it says the 1 to 5% IRA contribution is forwarded to the main IRA database. It doesn't say the signal representative of the payment amount of the 1 to 5% contribution. It says the contribution itself.
I understand, but it also doesn't say that the funds are deposited in the individual's account. In the next sentence, it talks about the account, and this is the discussion we have in our brief about the two different signal paths that occur here, where one is for data and one is for money. And there's a transfer of funds that goes from the individual's deposit account to the individual's savings account, and there's a transfer of data that gets displayed in the database that's kept by the...
Sequentially, doesn't the display in the database happen before the money goes into the savings account?
The display of data occurs before the funds go into the account.
So that's an intervening step.
It's not an intervening step in the transfer of the money.
So what?
Well, that's what
you served up a definition of direct, meaning without an intervening step or agency.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. And we argued that there was no intervening account. No place where the money goes.
It says without an intervening step. So it seemed to me that the problem here was an overly broad definition of directly that you served up and the board accepted. What you were trying to do here, by directly, was to say not Burke. Burke was indirect because Burke had an intervening account. Had a cookie jar where you deposited little bits of money until it got big enough to move along with somebody else. And to get around Burke, you were trying to say, we don't have an intervening account.
That's correct.
But instead of amending your claim to say that, you amended the claim to say we are direct, and by direct means there's no intervening step of any kind whatsoever.
In the transfer of funds.
It doesn't say that.
The amendment to the term...
To me, it's a defining the term. What does directly mean?
Right, it's a direct transfer of funds. That's what the patent is directed to. It's directed to a transfer of funds from a deposit account to a savings account.
Without an intervening step, but it doesn't say without an intervening step to another account. It's just without an intervening step.
Without an intervening step in the transfer of the funds, not without any intervening step in some collateral process that shows a display of data. That's not a transfer of funds from one account to another. That's a data display, and it's explained in the patent.
Well, that's what the case is all about, is did your disclosure after your amendment make clear that what you were trying to say by directly was not Burke, or whether you were saying, well, not any intervening step of any kind. And the board, to me, was reading it on the broad side because they said, well, we'll grant you your definition. And then you have a problem. I mean, there's not, under the board's definition of direct, there's not going to be a direct transfer in any of these patents because there's too much collateral things happening.
Well,
as you know.
Yes, I understand. But I think the direct has to be read in conjunction with the transfer of funds. And it's the direct transfer of funds from account to account.
That's the missing element to me in what's stated in your disclosure, given the way the case is served up by the definition of direct.
But I think if you read the entire disclosure, including the abstract, the originally issued claims, the portions of the specification that we point to throughout the brief, you never see anything other than a direct transfer of funds from account to account when you look at the transfer of funds. When you look at transfers of data, there may be something that intervenes between a transfer of funds, but that, as we point out in our brief, is on a different signal path from the transfer of the funds. The
but
data,
your original disclosure was broad enough to read on Burke. So your original disclosure would deal with an indirect transfer to an account.
Well, we didn't think the original disclosure was broad enough to read on Burke, and we argued against that in the reexamination proceedings, but we ultimately amended the claim to further clarify and distinguish the claim from Burke. But Burke is a great example of what an intervening account or structure is. Burke has a clearinghouse account where funds are accumulated until they're sufficient enough to be distributed to other accounts. There's nothing like that shown in the 533 patent.
So specifically, what is, when you ask for a remand on the basis of a new ground of rejection, would you be explicit as to what you view as the new ground?
Yes, Your Honor. There were actually two new grounds of rejection that we identified in the brief. The first was that the board found that in the specification of the 533 patent, transfers could have been performed directly or indirectly without an explicit disclosure of either, and that appears at Joint Appendix A15. The examiner never made that argument in addressing the direct limitation. In fact, the examiner's reasoning for rejecting the direct limitation was just that the word didn't appear in the specification. There was never any real discussion of why there was no support in the specification. So here, the first new ground of rejection is that the transfer could have been performed directly or indirectly without an explicit disclosure of either. This second new ground of directory, second new ground of rejection is the car analogy that was used by the board that was never demonstrated by the examiner. We never had an opportunity to address that with the examiner.
Okay, let's hear from the office. Please save some rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. May it please the court. This case presents a clear example of why our law needs a written description requirement. 10 years ago, when Barton filed its patent application, they explained their invention conceptually and broadly as an automated savings fund, a way for a user to have little amounts of money sent automatically to their savings account. In fact, they specified the automated nature of their invention no fewer than 27 times in their patent. But not once did they say that the transfer was direct.
But the board, in explaining its decision, said that really doesn't matter.
Well, what I think
in this new ground that was asserted.
Well, let's be clear that there was no new ground. The grounds by the examiner, the grounds by the board, it's the same grounds. There's no disclosure of a direct transfer. The part that Barton is citing to, the part of the board's decision, merely said after Barton urged the board, as it urged this court today, to read the whole patent and somewhere in there find the disclosure, what the board said is, well, you don't specify that it's direct or indirect. So it's really both to the extent it's either. They're trying to get the breadth of their disclosure, and from the breadth they're trying to get to a description of something.
But isn't that actually wrong? How else do you read column 6, lines 11 through 16? I don't see how you can say they don't articulate support for indirect if they wanted to claim it, because it expressly says IRA contribution forwarded to an IRA database, then the IRA contribution sent to the individual account. That would be an indirect transfer as far as I can tell. So isn't the board as a factual matter wrong based on the way you also interpret the spec at column 6, lines 11 through 15?
I think the problem with answering that directly is that the term wasn't used in the specification, so we don't really know what it means.
Kelly, either this is direct or it's indirect.
If it's either,
which one
it's,
is it?
If it's either, it's indirect. It
well, how can it not be one of the two, right? I
mean, because it's ambiguous.
This is a binary world. You can't say it's, you know, I choose color gray. I mean, what is
it? Well, first of all, it is ambiguous. I think that at best for them, it's ambiguous. I agree with Your Honor that if it's one or the other, it's closer to direct. To the extent we even know what indirect, to the extent we even know what indirect means, because their patent doesn't describe one or the other. With respect to the binary nature of this claim limitation, it's always possible to reduce the universe of claim limitations to a binary nature where it's either is or isn't.
I think we were going to say the same thing. Perhaps that's exactly what prosecution is about. Prior art is cited. It looks as if some of the terms that you've used may read more broadly than now becomes apparent or prudent to limit the claims. You say, all right, I limit it to direct, but I don't have to worry about Burke anymore.
Well, that would be true, Your Honor, if they had described both sides of the binary equation. If
they
had described
it broadly, as the board itself says.
Well, Your Honor, a broad definition, even a description that renders something obvious, as this court said in Ariad, doesn't render it described per 112 first paragraph. This limitation could have said where the transfers occur during daylight hours or occur at night. Well, that's a binary thing. One or the other has to occur, but they disclose neither. They could have said where the transfers are in U.S. currency or not U.S. currency, whether they are certain protocols used or not, whether they're electronic or paper transfers.
So you're saying that somebody with a claim that turns out to be a little too broad because of the cited references is prohibited from cutting back to that which does not include the reference subject matter?
I'm not saying that, Your Honor. And I think in In re Johnson in the CCPA, the CCPA made clear that that's an appropriate thing to do. When an applicant...
That's what they did?
It's not what they did, respectfully, Your Honor. What happened in In re Johnson was that an applicant had a number of subspecies, and then in order to get around the prior art, they basically excluded a couple of them. And the board said, well, you essentially created a brand new subspecies, and the CCPA said, that's okay. They're just narrowing their scope to some of the species that they did disclose to exclude others. There's nothing to prevent them from doing that. The problem here is that they didn't disclose a direct transfer. Now, arguably, they didn't disclose the details of any transfer, but Your Honor is correct, and the court, I think, is right, that with those two sentences from step six, if anything's disclosed, it's an indirect transfer.
So that happens in less than a nanosecond. The transfer refers to the IRA contribution to the IRA database and then to the individual account. It's just how it moves.
I don't know, Your Honor, if there's anything in the reference that talks about the speed at which it moves. And I want to clarify.
No, but if you're saying that this absolutely is an inexorable two-step process and they're stuck with it because that's what was described, things always work in sequence, no matter what.
Well, if it works in sequence, it's beyond the scope of their description and their claim, because what their claim now says, according to them, is that direct means without an intervening step. And what they've said here today is that step six, the first half of the step six, which they want to get away from as quickly as possible, is just the transfer of data and it's not the transfer of funds.
So this is a specific example for John Doe
right.
and his $200. Doesn't say this is the only way it works.
It's the only way they describe it as working, Your Honor. They can't wait 10 years, find a prior art reference, and have their attorneys invent a new description or a new embodiment that they never had to begin with. And let's remember, in the step six that they're focusing on so much, there's a step that comes before it, step five. And in step five, that's where the money comes out of the first account. So it's incorrect for them to say that the only transfer occurs in the second half of step six, because once we're through step five, the money's out of the account. It's gone somewhere. And now we have the intervening step where it's first sent to the institution, whereas they say that's just a data transfer. And in the second step, after that intervening step, it's sent to the account. That clearly puts it beyond the direct definition that they've given and the one the board's adopted. And it's really the only one the board can adopt because this patent doesn't describe what they mean by direct or indirect. It just doesn't. They can't take a broad disclosure and wait to see the prior art and come up with a new invention. That's what the written description doctrine is meant to police.
If this claim had said, of the individual directly to a savings program provider of the individual, so the money was directly going to the savings program provider, not necessarily directly to the savings account without a stopover, but directly to the provider, would this patent provide written description support for that?
I don't think so, and I don't think if it said that, and that's what the claim meant, that they would even necessarily have gotten around the prior art.
They would. The prior art went to a central facility, which was not part of the savings program provider. It was not the same bank. The same bank didn't hold in both of those components. So you're sending it now. It has to go to the same bank. Can't go to some third party for collection until it gets big enough to get moved.
Well,
so it would have gotten around it. So why doesn't this spec support it?
I don't know that I necessarily agree with how Your Honor has characterized Burke. It may go to a clearinghouse, but I think the problem with Burke is that it didn't get to the account holder's account right away. Because bear in mind what Burke was doing. They didn't
pretend want. Pretend you agree with me on Burke. Move on. Go to my point, which is if it had said savings program provider, why in the world wouldn't the spec be adequately supported?
Because the provider might not be depositing into the account right away. The provider might for.
What does that have to do with getting over Burke? Nothing. If
who cares in terms of the written description support?
The written description, figure 6 shows credit debit provider with an arrow straight to savings program provider. Why wouldn't that be adequate support if the claim just said it went directly to a savings program provider? There's nothing shown between the arrow at 26 and 28 on figure 6.
Well,
why wouldn't figure 6 standing alone be enough?
It might be enough for that claim limitation. We obviously don't have that in front of us, so I can't answer
don't
that
with
a
question.
Think the claim,
the claim or the figure. You have the patent, right?
Well, we don't have the. Well, in order to do the written description analysis, we need the claim. We need to know what they're trying to claim. And I assume what Your Honor is suggesting is a claim that said it goes directly to the provider. And I think the court's question is there support for that?
Yeah.
And my answer is because the board didn't deal with that question, I don't know what the actual answer to that is. But I do understand the court's intuition that that potentially is supported by that figure. And it might be. The problem is I don't think that would have gotten them around Burke necessarily. Because what's happening in Burke is...
For the purposes of our analysis, that's not what the claim says.
Right, that's not what the claim says. The claim is much more specific than that. It had to be to get around Burke. That's why they amended the claim. What Burke is doing is it's keeping these little pennies and nickels and quarters in a bucket somewhere. Maybe in an intermediate's bucket. It could be within a bucket within a bank. Right, so that the customer sees once a month the dump of all of the savings that they've made through these little deductions throughout the month. That's why it could be doing it that way. So to say that it just goes directly to the provider, I don't know that it would have gotten around at birth, but it may have been. The problem is that's not what it says. It says directly to the account. And the only language that we have in this patent anywhere that talks about the transfer from one account to another is in Step 6. And Mr. Grady said here this morning that what Step 6 looks like is two steps. Well, if he's right that Step 6 looks like two steps, that's clearly substantial evidence to support the board's factual finding that there was no disclosure of a single step transfer, which is what they need to overcome the rejection.
So what would have happened if, during the course of the amendment, when the patentee was trying to get by Burke, he said, I'm going to put the word directly transfer in there, and by directly what I mean is not Burke. I mean directly simply means not going into an intermediate account. It does not mean that there can't be an intervening step of some sort, but it simply doesn't go into an intervening account. And they had said that when they wrote up their response to the examiner and put in their amendment.
Well, we might be...
And then we're going to look at the written description we have here and say, well, does this written description show possession of direct transfer as defined by the patentee?
They may have been closer to having a description of that. The problem that they face is that they have a very, very strong prior art rejection. And so they have to move from a continuum, a starting place where they have a description, their broad description of their broad claim, to an ending place where they have an actual prior art rejection. They've got to move down that continuum. They chose to move far enough, in their view, to get around the prior art, but they moved so far that they got away from their description. Now, if Your Honor is suggesting there was some intermediate language that maybe didn't go quite to this direct transfer directly to an account, but carved out a little bit less from their written description and perhaps went a little bit less to overcoming the prior art, there might have been some point in that continuum when they would have cleared the written description hurdle. But I suspect that we would be here talking about an obvious misrejection.
Can I ask you a somewhat theoretical question that bothers me about this? Suppose there was no Burke and this was the claim, not necessarily as originally filed, but it's the claim,
mm-hmm.
And it included the word directly, and then you all came along and said, no, you have to take the word directly out of the claim, there's no written description support. The patentee does a little happy dance because you're basically telling him he has to have a broader claim. Then he would take the word directly out, and he would theoretically be entitled to get this claim based on his written description support. Is that right? If there was no Burke, no prior art reference, it was creating an obstacle to it.
Well, that's essentially what happened during the original prosecution. We didn't have the step of him putting in directly and us telling him to take it out, but he got a broad claim that was consistent with his broad disclosure. Yes.
So I guess what I just don't understand as a theoretical matter is, why is it that a written description is adequate to support a broader claim but not a narrower claim? As a theoretical matter,
okay.
It bothers me, just theoretically, that you're saying, the patent office is saying, no, you can have a broader claim, you just don't have enough specifics to get this narrower one. Because then he could theoretically go assert the broader claim against someone who is doing it directly or indirectly, even though he describes neither.
He could, Your Honor, but here's the problem, and here's how the patent system functions. What happens is that the innovator who sees his disclosure can come in and make an improvement. They can come up with their own better way of doing this, their direct way, and they could actually get a patent on that. Now, you're right.
You're saying that he could come in with his own reference cited against him and now claim direct?
No, Your Honor. I'm saying we're talking about two different people in the market. So Barton gets a broad patent based on their broad disclosure, and then a second person comes in, and they read that disclosure, and they come up with an improvement, say the direct transfer model, and they get a patent on that. That might be patentable over this. Okay. Well, when that happens, that second patent blocks Barton's ability to practice that improvement, but at the same time, Barton's broad patent blocks the innovator's narrower improvement patent. That happens every day in our patent system. That's what improvement patents are about.
Well, that's an interesting theoretical situation, but you can't say that applies here. He has a broad statement in the beginning of the transfer. The transfer takes place. Then he has this example with number 6 where he says that it proceeds. The first thing that happens is that it is forwarded to the main IRA database, and then the second one is that it goes to the account. As an example of the transfer, doesn't say you can't go directly from one to the other, just as in my example, you take the 1 to 5% and here it goes. So you're saying that someone else, but not this inventor, could claim the direct transfer?
I'm saying that someone who invented a direct transfer and who described the direct transfer.
You're saying that it's patentable over this disclosure, but that's not what Barton is trying to do. He's saying that's part of my disclosure.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, he is trying to say it's patentable over disclosure of an indirect transfer.
He says it's patentable over the prior art, not over his own disclosure.
But his disclosure, he doesn't describe the direct transfer at all. That's the problem. All I'm trying to do in answering Judge Moore's question...
Well, that's undoubtedly why the board went to written description rather than overruled the obviousness, anticipation.
Because neither party describes a direct transfer. Neither Burke nor Barton. The court has no further questions. Thank you.
Okay. Any more questions for Mr. Kelly? Thank you, Mr. Kelly. Mr. Grady, you have a little time. Just 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. The direct transfer was described in originally issued Claim 1, where it said automatically contributing funds from a deposit account of an individual to a savings program account of the individual based upon debit transactions made by the individual. That's a direct transfer from account to account. The
original, was Burke automatic?
I'm sorry?
Was Burke automatic?
Burke was automatic in the sense that there was a debit transaction.
Well, I think the way I understood what you were saying is because of the word automatic, that means it's direct.
No, it's because the funds went from a deposit account of an individual to a savings program account of the individual, one account to the other, direct, no intervening step or agency involved at all in that transfer. That's an originally issued Claim 1. In the original prosecution history, there was a...
Was Claim 1, that part of Claim 1 present as filed, or was that...
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Original Claim 1 that issued with the 533 patent was the original claim as filed on the day of the filing and not amended?
No, it was not a... I'm sorry, I misunderstood the question. I appreciate that. That original Claim 1 was... That's originally issued Claim 1, not as originally filed. So that's a claim that appears in the printed patent that is up on appeal today, that originally automatically contributing funds from a deposit account of an individual to a savings program account of the individual based on debit transactions.
But you understand our confusion, because if this was originally filed Claim 1 on the date of filing, then it could itself provide the written description support you're looking for.
Right. The claim was discussed during the original prosecution history, and in the prosecution history, this is reproduced at the joint appendix at page A1009 to 1010. There's a discussion of a prior art reference, and the patentee says, in neither aspect of the Fernandez-Holman disclosure is money transferred from a deposit account to a savings account, nor is the money transferred from the deposit account to the savings account, the customer's money that has previously been deposited. It is therefore submitted that the Fernandez-Holman teaching would not lead one skilled in the art to the requirements of applicants Claim 11, particularly as amended. And Claim 11, as amended, included the phrase computer usable code having computer readable program code means embodied therein for automatically contributing funds from a deposit account of an individual to a savings program account of the individual based upon debit transactions made by the individual. So this is in the original prosecution history. Prosecution Claim 11 describes that account-to-account transfer of money, and there's a discussion of the need to have a direct transfer from account to account in the prosecution history and overcoming the prior art.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Grady, and thank you, Mr. Kelly. The case is taken into submission. Spectralytics Incorporated against Cordis Corporation and Norman Noble. Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. This is the enhancement of damages case where the willfulness was based exclusively on the defendant's pre-suit conduct. The case was here earlier and you remanded it on account of the fact that the district court judge discounted that pre-suit conduct, and on remand the district court judge has again discounted that conduct. With respect to Noble, the court held that it was not reprehensible for Noble to have ignored the patent because of the fact that Noble had received an indemnification from its largest customer, Cordis. If Noble had investigated the patent, it might have decided not to manufacture, in which case Cordis wouldn't have had a supplier and there wouldn't have been any infringement. But it didn't do any investigation whatsoever. It totally ignored the patent. And there's absolutely no authority giving a party a pass on enhanced damages because it has been indemnified with respect to actual damages by its customer. In fact, giving a party a pass on enhanced damages violates the purposes and the objectives of enhanced damage law. And we ask that the case be remanded back to the district court to consider specific enhanced damages against Noble. Now, as to Cordis, there again was a discounting of the pre-suit conduct. Here, the court ordered enhanced damages of $500,000, a 0.02 multiplier of actual damages. Well, that amount of money does not punish Cordis, and that amount of money will not deter Cordis from doing anything at all. And it resulted from an erroneous application of several of the Reed factors, which we discussed in our brief, but I'd like to talk about Reed factor 5, which is the closeness of the willfulness case. Here, the district court judge did not even consider the closeness of the willfulness case. If he would have considered it, he would have looked at the evidence that caused him to say that Cordis didn't take Spectralytics seriously even until the lawsuit was filed. If he had considered that evidence, he would have considered the evidence of both objective and subjective of the reckless behavior of Cordis prior to being sued. But he didn't do any of that. Instead, what he did was to say, well, this case, when it was tried, was close. And he substituted that for looking at the closeness of the willfulness case. Now, Cordis will say, well, there are plenty of cases where the court looks at the closeness of the case as tried. And they are. And in Seagate, you distinguish between pre-suit and post-suit willfulness. And you said, in the case of post-suit willfulness, a reasonable defense on the merits will tend to defeat a claim of willfulness where the willfulness is based upon post-filing conduct. And that's because, in that case, the time frame and the evidence are the same. In our case, the evidence was based upon pre-filing conduct. And the time frame for that evidence is completely different for that from when the case is tried. What happened is that the case was submitted to the jury. They were given the Seagate instruction, and they were given further help as you, Judge Newman, suggested ought to occur.
Counsel, even if the district court erred, as you're suggesting, by considering the closeness of the case in the infringement suit, even if that's true, he went on, after he did that, probably in response to your argument, He considered the closeness of the infringement and validity cases, and then he said, finally, even if the court were to consider only the closeness of the willfulness case, the court would indeed find the willfulness case was close. And he went on for two paragraphs to explain why that is. So why isn't that clearly an alternative finding that absolutely supports his closeness of the case analysis? He did both. He didn't want to fall prey to the error on appeal that you're possibly pointing out, so he went ahead and analyzed it under the other way as well.
Well, with all due respect, Your Honor, I don't think he did. What he said was, I'm going to do that. And then when he started to do it, what he said was that I'm finding that the case, when it was tried, was close. As I said, he didn't examine the evidence that caused even he to say that Cordes didn't take spectrolytics seriously until the case was filed. If he would have examined that evidence, he would have decided then whether the case was close when it was filed. If he would have examined the objective and subjective evidence prior to filing, then he would have done that. He would have considered the closeness of the willfulness case. But in that paragraph where he said, I'm going to do it, what he has said in the prior paragraphs or two is that they are bound together. Okay. He did not understand Seagate.
So are you suggesting that the willfulness allegations that you made don't extend into the period of time once the litigation was filed?
Oh, absolutely. What happened in this
case? Absolutely.
Absolutely, I'm suggesting that.
Or they absolutely do extend.
No, absolutely, I'm suggesting that. What happened?
I still don't understand whether you're answering my question yes or no because of my negative in my question. So are you saying the willfulness period, what exactly in your mind is the willfulness period of time?
Prior to the filing of the case.
Once the case was filed, you're not accusing any infringement that occurred after the lawsuit as being willful?
That's correct.
Okay. Well, so then your .002 number or whatever it is woefully wrong, right? Because of the $22 million, when I look back at damages, most of those damages were attributed to sales that occurred after this lawsuit was filed. So if you're looking at what the multiplier is for willfulness, don't you have to look at the only damages period which is available for willfulness?
Well, I respectfully disagree. Most of the damages weren't after the case was filed. Most of them were before.
What is the breakdown?
If
you're going to come up and give us a multiplier and say the district court judge only awarded 0.2% enhanced damages, then don't you think the compensatory amount you're looking at ought to track exactly with the willfulness period?
If you take out post-filing, maybe it'll go to 0.3. Most of the damages were pre-filing damages.
But they continued the activity, did they not?
Yes, they did.
I'm trying to understand why one would draw the line that we're discussing.
Well, I'll tell you why. The jury was given the Seagate instruction, and they were told that as a part of that, they should examine the objective and subjective evidence considered from the perspective of a reasonable person in the defendant's position acting in accordance with fair standards of commerce. And the first thing they did was they sent a note back to the judge. And they said, when do I do this? When do I look at whether this person was reasonable? And they suggested five different times. The judge called the lawyers up, we spoke by telephone, and we told the judge it ought to be the time prior to the filing of the case. So the judge then went back to the jury and gave them an instruction that said that the willfulness period in this case is prior to the filing of the case. Willfulness was based exclusively on that time frame. This is discussed, I think, at the very beginning of our reply brief. We get into the facts relating to this. As far as that jury instruction, you'll find that at Appendix 329 and 1297. So, the point is that the closeness of the case had nothing to do with the willfulness. They were two different time frames. And the problem with what the district court judge has done, and the effect of that, is that it will encourage defendants like Cordes to recklessly disregard the rights of others because they know two things. One, if they do that, a lot of these people will go away. Spectralytics was a $2 million a year in sales company. Cordes was a $50 billion a year in sales company. When Cordes said to Spectralytics, no problem here, guys, and they totally ignored the patent. Most companies like Spectralytics would have walked away, and Cordis would have ended up stealing their intellectual property. The second thing that they know, based upon what the judge has done here, is that if they are ever sued by the Spectralytics of the world, if they're tagged with willful infringement, they can escape enhanced damages by showing that they're putting together a close case on the merits. And I'll guarantee you that a $50 billion a year company can do that. They can make a case look close. In fact, in this case, they brought together 15 very fine lawyers, and their mere gravitas caused our district court judge to believe that this case was close. But it wasn't close. It was not a close case. A case is not close on the merits where, on validity, one of the elements of the invention is not even in the prior art. And the defendant's expert testifies that the prior art teaches away from the invention. And a case is not close on the merits on non-infringement, where your non-infringement argument defies common sense. It defied common sense for them to try to tell the jury that a tube that fits within a bushing is not smaller than the bushing, despite the fact that the tube fits in there, slides, and turns in the bushing. But the judge bought their argument that the case was close. And even analyzing whether the case was close, it's very interesting to see what he relied upon. He said the case is close as evidenced by the fact that I would have decided it the other way. That's not evidence. Evidence is the prior art, secondary considerations, etc. So the closeness of the case is not something that inured to their benefit. And with respect to Reed Factor 5, it should not have been considered because it involved a different time frame altogether.
Was the closeness of the case adjudicated in a previous appeal?
Well, not specifically. I think that there are many things that were decided that inform us on that point.
Another previous decision, actually, you challenged that in your cross appeal, I believe, expressly. I know you did.
Yes, we did allude to that, but I don't think
you have a separate section in your brief.
Yes, we said there that the case was not close. I don't think that this court weighed in on that.
Okay, let's hear from the other side, Mr. Carlson.
All right, thank you.
Okay, Mr. Gallertner, you're sharing your time?
I am sharing my time. I'll be 9 minutes for Cordis, and then Mr. Niehaus will have the other 6 minutes, Your Honor. This is the second time this case is in front of this court on the issue of willfulness. The first time, the district judge had discounted the second Reed factor, which involves consideration of the patent in suit, and this court held that it was error to discount that factor cannot be ignored, and that the determination of willfulness depends on the egregiousness of the defendant's conduct in light of all the facts and circumstances. The case was then remanded, and on remand, the district court did exactly what this court said it should do. The district court considered the egregiousness in light of all the facts and circumstances. It awarded $500,000. It changed the result. The earlier appeal, there had been no award at all. And in the second appeal, the court awarded $500,000 because it was now explicitly, although Mr. Carlson says that the district court did not consider factor number two and discounted it, the district court said exactly the opposite at A5. He said he was considering every factor without discounting any of them. And considering all the factors, the district court determined, and again I'm quoting the district court at A12, that Cordis' conduct was not particularly egregious, so that if an adequate sanction was $500,000. The reason the court determined that sanction, that result rested heavily on the court's views as to the closeness of the case. And before I get to the closeness of the case, I would just like to touch briefly on one other issue, which relates to Spectralytics' assertion that Norman Noble got a free pass. That's what I heard Mr. Carlson say in his in his argument, that Norman Noble was given a free pass. Norman Noble didn't get a free pass. This is something Mr. Niehaus is going to be addressing. But the court's opinion is clear. When the judge uses the term Cordes in his opinion, he states in footnote 1 on page A2 that he's using the term Cordes to refer to both defendants, so that when he imposes an award of $500,000 on Cordes, that is an award on both defendants. That's confirmed by the judgment, which gives Spectralytics $500,000 for defendants, S apostrophe, plural misconduct. Nobody got a free pass. The determination that Cordes' conduct was not particularly egregious on this record was amply supported by the facts and certainly a permissible exercise of the district judge's discretion. The judge sat through pretrial proceedings, presided over the trial, and after doing so, was of the view that Cordes had presented strong defenses both on infringement and on willfulness. And there's no basis for challenging that termination. The challenge that Spectralytics offers is basically based on two arguments. Their first argument is a legal argument, the argument that the determination of closeness of the case only relates to willfulness, not a determination of the merits. And I think that argument fails for three reasons. First, it fails because, as Judge Moore noted, this judge expressly considered not only the closeness of the case on infringement and the closeness of the case on willfulness, he also considered the closeness of the case on infringement and validity. He also considered the closeness of the case on willfulness, and he expressly found at pages A12 and A15 that this was a very close case, not only on infringement, but also on willfulness. And that determination is frankly unassailable. The argument that a district judge should not consider the merits issues on willfulness and infringement has two basic problems. One is inconsistent.
Let me tell you what my problem with the case is.
Sure.
Having sat on the prior one, I didn't think it was close on infringement, but the district judge did. The district court therefore announces that there will be a very modest penalty because of the way he sees the case. And I've been arguing with myself as to the amount of deference. Is that entitled to total deference as a matter of discretion?
If I can just one point, Your Honor. Your Honor could not have reached the view on infringement that the infringement case was not close because infringement was not subject to the prior appeal. Okay? We didn't appeal the infringement issue. We had a limited number of issues to appeal.
The validity. Okay.
And first of all, there are two issues that he decided were close issues after hearing all the evidence. They were both close. This court has repeatedly recognized that the determination of whether an issue is close or not is a determination that's best suited for the district court to make.
My inquiry was related really to the amount of deference. This is a matter of total deference.
It's substantial evidence.
The judge is entitled to.
This court has repeatedly held, Amstead and other cases, that the judge's determination on the closeness of the case is entitled to deference, and that's based on the fact that the judge sits in the courtroom, observes the demeanor of the witnesses. This court doesn't. So the review of the district court's determination on there being a close case on willfulness, on invalidity, is something that's only reversible for clear error. And there is only clear error if there's only one permissible view of the evidence. If reasonable fact finders could view the evidence two different ways, then as a matter of law, that is not clear error. So while Your Honor might, and has told me you do view the evidence differently than the district judge, that's not enough to overturn the district judge's ruling. You'd have to come to the conclusion that no reasonable person could reach the conclusion that the district judge reached. If a reasonable person hearing that evidence could find that there was a strong case on validity, a case that would have persuaded a reasonable fact finder,
Aren't you describing the substantial evidence standard, not the clear error standard?
Well, the clear error standard has been described by appellate courts and the Supreme Courts as if there are two permissible views of the evidence, a judge who adopts one
Right, that's different from whether no reasonable person could reach the conclusion.
That's absolutely right. In applying the clear error standard, you're not required to view the evidence in the light most favorable and ignore other evidence. But where there are two permissible views of the evidence, then it's not clear error to adopt one.
You say that we owe some deference to the district court judge's determination that this case was close?
Correct.
And so what's our standard of review? What's the test? Is it abuse of discretion? What?
You review the fact determination that it was a close case. That determination is reviewed for clear error. The balancing of all of the nine Reed factors is reviewed for abuse of discretion under Cybor and Odetics and other cases. And, you know, certainly there were close, the district judge found that there were close cases, a close issue on infringement. Mr. Carlson belittles that, but it was a fairly straightforward issue. The claim required that the bushing have an outer diameter that's sized to be slightly greater than the inner diameter of the tubing that goes into it. And the testimony at trial was that what that requires is what's called in the art a running and sliding fit. And to have a running and sliding fit, you need a certain clearance between the outer diameter of the outer diameter of the tubing that goes into the bushing and the bushing's inner diameter. And we simply didn't have that. We had tubing, a bushing that's made of Teflon, and what the Teflon allows is to have tubing that has exactly the same outer diameter as the inner diameter of the bushing. So rather than being a gap, there was an exact identity. They were sized to be exactly the same, not sized to be slightly different as the patent requires. And we recognize that the jury found against us on that, but the judge heard all the evidence, and he came to the conclusion that most reasonable juries would have ruled on their favor on that issue. And in light of his views on the closeness of the infringement issue and the invalidity issue, he found that there was a close case on willfulness as well, because willfulness under the first prong of Seagate is tied to the closeness of the merits issue, where there's a reasonable defense on the merits. Then that necessarily defeats willfulness under Seagate. What I heard during Mr. Carlson's argument was an effort to completely rewrite the willfulness standard in a way, to my hearing, would completely eliminate the first prong of Seagate for willful infringement that occurs prior to the commencement of suit. And that's just not what Seagate is about. Under Seagate, there aren't two separate standards. The objective prong applies. The two prongs of Seagate apply to both portions of the willfulness period. Excuse me.
I'm listening.
Yeah.
I'm just listening.
Yeah, okay.
Do you want to continue or to share your time?
Sure. Well, I don't have... I don't want to impinge on Mr. Niehaus's time, so if
you're
I would do that...
You are doing that.
I don't want to do that. I'm sorry. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Mr. Niehaus?
Good morning. Thank you. My name is James Niehaus. I represent Norman Noble. Norman Noble did not get a free pass because of the indemnification clause. If Norman Noble had been given a free pass, there would have been no need for the district judge to apply the Reed factors to Noble's conduct. But if you review the opinion, that's exactly what the district judge did. Factor number one, copying. There's no allegation in the case that Cordis ever had access to Spectralytics' invention. There's no allegation that Cordis copied the invention. The allegation was that Noble copied. The district court spent a page of its brief, its opinion, analyzing and concluding that the evidence failed to show that Noble copied. Spectralytics then spent five pages of its fact section, two pages of its argument, and a portion of its reply brief, arguing that the district court erred in how the district court applied that factor to Noble's conduct. By making that argument, they're conceding that the district court applied the Reed factors to Noble's conduct and did
can
not
we,
give
can
Noble
a
free pass.
Can we get to the bottom of the indemnification point? Let's assume, for purposes of argument, that you're right as to all of the Reed factors except perhaps for two. What was the effect of the indemnification on the district court's assessment of Noble's satisfaction of the second element of Reed?
Ultimately, Noble, the district court weighed that factor against Noble. It would be an interesting issue.
Where do we see that?
Where do we see that? In the district court's opinion, where the district court said Reed factor number two weighed against the defendants.
That was outweighed by the but not to the point of assessing damages.
The court, district court did assess damages, $500,000 against the defendants.
Against Noble personally? Noble is indemnified.
The indemnification is irrelevant to the award of damages. The damages were awarded against the defendants. Read factor number two.
What do you do with an opinion that says under read factor two, without ever talking specifically about Noble, all the conversations about Cordes? He says we find the second read factor weighs in favor of damages.
Right.
And he said earlier, whenever I say Cordes, I mean Cordes and Noble.
Correct.
And then over on page 8 of his opinion, when talking about size and financial condition, he says, under these circumstances, I see nothing particularly reprehensible about the fact that Noble didn't launch an independent investigation, but instead relied on Cordes because of the indemnification.
Because of the indemnification. He said, Noble relied on Cordes' investigation. There's nothing reprehensible about that.
It says Noble relied on Cordes' indemnification, so that it doesn't matter.
No, he said that Noble relied on Cordes' investigation.
Well, Noble, what evidence is there of that? Because there's no evidence in the record that Cordes did any investigation. So how can Noble rely on a fictionary thing?
Well, there is evidence in the record that Cordes did an investigation because there's Mr. Coletti's letter, which is discussed extensively in Cordes' brief.
And incredibly superficial and doesn't really say anything. But so if that's what you relied on...
We relied to our peril, and it came back to haunt us because now we've been assessed $500,000 in enhanced damages because we relied on Cordes.
You're saying that the enhancement is assessed against Noble, not against Cordes?
It's assessed against both of them. It's assessed against the defendants.
And I don't understand. You've told us to ignore the indemnification, or you're telling us that there is no indemnification.
No, I'm not telling you to ignore the indemnification, or I'm saying there is no indemnification. There is an indemnification clause.
So it doesn't matter, does it, whether Noble is included or not in the willfulness?
Well, I think it does matter.
Why?
It
didn't cost you anything. As a matter of commercial ethics, we set that aside. I think the commercial ethics here... may not stand the light of day, but as far as the issue of indemnification, Noble has no risk, do they?
Certainly Noble has risk when you rely solely on indemnification.
They have a risk that Cordes doesn't have any money.
That's correct.
Is the indemnification clause enforceable in Ohio?
The indemnification clause is enforceable in Ohio for damages. As to whether it's enforceable, if Cordes refuses to pay the award and the award is sought from Noble, then it is unlikely in Ohio that Noble would be able to enforce the indemnification clause against Cordes.
I don't understand how you can say that Noble was sanctioned $500,000. The opinion itself has to be read as a whole. And at page 14 of the opinion, the court, in the conclusion, says, on balance, the court finds that Cordes should be penalized by an award of $500,000 in enhanced damages. Although this amount is small compared to Cordes' revenues, yada, yada, yada. That's the conclusion of the entire thing. I do see in the order it says, plaintiff Spectralytics shall take enhanced damages in the amount of $500,000 for the defendant's willful infringement. But I don't see how that is attributable to Noble. You have to read the entire opinion together, and the opinion taken as a whole is clear that only Cordes is on the line for the $500,000. So I don't see how you conclude that Noble was somehow assessed a $500,000 enhanced damages.
Because in footnote 1, the court said Cordes means Cordes and Noble. And so there are times in the opinion where he used Cordes. There are times in the opinion where he used Cordes to refer to Noble. without separately specifying Noble, there are times in the opinion where he used Cordes to mean both Cordes and Noble.
We said in his opinion, we find that this sum adequately penalizes Cordes. That's at the top of page 14 of the opinion.
Yes.
And they have also determined that there is no need separately to penalize Noble.
There's no need to enter a separate and additional award against Noble, is how I've read that opinion.
Well, he also says in footnote 1 that Cordes agreed to indemnify Noble.
Yes.
It doesn't look as if the court thought that there was anything further outstanding that he needed to do or say.
Except, but then he goes on in the opinion to evaluate, read factor number 7, for example, remedial steps taken. He specifically references remedial steps taken by Noble to cease use of the, what little use they were still making of the infringing device shortly after trial. He went and evaluated each of the factors as to Noble. If Noble was getting a complete free pass, there was no need for him to do that, and yet that's what he did. Copying. It's only Noble's conduct that he's talking about, and yet that becomes a very important part of his opinion as well as their appeal. So he didn't give Noble a free pass because of the indemnification.
Okay. Any more questions? Any more questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Niehaus. Mr. Carlson.
With respect to Noble, we ask that the court separately assess punitive damages against Noble. And the court said at page 8 of its opinion, appendix page 9, the court rejects that assessing a willfulness damage against Cordes and Noble. So there was willfulness damages ordered, but we all know as a practical matter what that means in the real world here. And it also means, we know, that Noble is not going to be paying any money. Now,
are both defendants jointly and severally liable for the $500,000?
I don't know. But here we've got a $50 billion company who didn't even ask for a supersedious bond on this appeal.
But that size, just that's a different issue. We didn't talk earlier about whether or not the district court erred by taking into consideration the size of the royalty when it dialed up the punities. Didn't the district court sort of nod and say, well, I think the actual royalty award is kind of high. And I believe we have a couple of cases that have suggested that it's all right for a district court judge to dial down enhanced damages if he thought the actuals were dialed up.
Yeah. Well, actually, the royalty rate was not high. The royalty rate was about as low as you could go.
This is in the mind of the judge.
Yes. Our expert testified that a 20% royalty would be realistic.
That, but the judge didn't see it that way.
Well, Your Honor,
I mean, what would we do if the only issue here was the $500,000, which is both Noble and Cordes are maybe on the hook for,
yeah,
as a matter of law, and you say, well, the money just isn't a high enough number, given what we know about the damages here. And the judge said, I just think the actual damages came in a little higher than I thought it should have been. I'm going to accept it, and I'm going to dial the punities down on account of that.
Well, I
would,
of course,
that be a reversible error?
I don't know. I don't know that there is a case. They cite the Reese case.
Well, there's language. There's language.
There's language
in
their
case that blesses, yeah, what happened below. And if,
yeah,
you know, if you're a good lawyer, you say, well, that has to have been holding because we sustained what the district court did.
But it wasn't the holding in that case. And I think that if that were the issue, we would have to brief it quite a bit more than we did in this case. But, you know, to a certain extent, this goes to whether we should defer to the district court judge. And I think you should take into account the fact that from the very beginning, this district court judge didn't like this patent. And he said so. In a summary judgment ruling, where the issue is whether there are genuine issues of material fact, he said the Cordes is going to win. That's not an issue. It was totally gratuitous. During the course of the case, he continuously said that Cordes had a very good argument on obviousness. The fact is, he didn't like this patent. The jury totally disagreed.
And yet he did his job impeccably But despite thinking Cordes was going to win, he didn't grant summary judgment. Despite thinking Cordes should have won, he didn't overturn the jury verdict.
That, I agree.
He did his job impeccably. He might have had his own preconceived notions about how the case should come out because he sat there and heard the same evidence everyone else heard.
Yes.
But he left intact what the jury did at all times.
Yes, I think that it has to be said that in the course of a trial, a judge makes hundreds of decisions. And we're not talking about a lot of errors here. What we're talking about is a decision on which he had discretion. And when he had discretion, he went the other way than what the jury did, because he felt from the very beginning that the case should go the other way. That's not an error of law, but it is an error of discretion, we believe, because the closeness of the case was not an actual factor in this case, where the willfulness was based upon and exclusively based upon pre-suit conduct. The jury asked, when am I to decide the objective and subjective criteria? They were told pre-suit. They asked about other periods. They were told, no, it's all pre-suit. What does it matter whether the case is tried could be close? Again, as I say, if you affirm what the district court judge did...
Yeah, but on that point, the district court judge is saying both these parties loused up. They made a terrible investigation. Their conduct pre-suit earns them... earns liability for enhanced damages.
So he's
got an equation here. He's got nine factors or whatever in the equation. He says there's one of them. Both of them were, they're both bad. And I'm not making your reprehensibility bad hat, white hat, black hat on Noble, because they were sort of like a wholly owned subsidiary. They were manufacturing, they were relying Noble. But he says, I take all the other factors together and I add them up, and one against H is enough for a small amount.
Well, the amount is...
Why is that reversible?
Well, what is reversible is not so much that point there. If he had not made other errors, and it's a issue of discretion, all I would be able to point to is his early issue on this patent that he expressed earlier. But what we're saying is he committed errors. He committed...
Well, the last time the error was clear, it was on read factor 2, because he said it doesn't count.
Yeah.
So he went back, and now he did read factor 2.
Right.
And you're not arguing he made a mistake on read factor 2.
Well...
Really?
Well, we are in our brief, but my main point here
which
is...
Which factor... We send it back this time, what are we telling him to do?
Tell him this time to take a look under read factor 5 of whether the willfulness case was close. That this issue about whether the case is tried was close is not a read factor in this case where the willfulness was dependent upon pre-filing conduct. Now, I'm not saying you can't consider that fact. Once you consider...
I already did figure it. I figured it out under read factor 2.
I'm sorry?
I thought the district court judge was saying I already figured that out on read factor 2.
Well, I can't tell you what was going through the mind of the judges when they put together the Reed case. I do know that what they purported to say was, I'm going to pull some cases from the prior case law that show ways that the court has decided whether to enhance damages. So they pulled all these cases together and they put them in some categories. Do they overlap? I don't know. They probably do. And maybe the judge found a little bit of overlap. Okay? But in the case of read factor 5,